KW233AH Monticello.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today, Climate March. Thousands took to the streets of New York for the March to End Fossil Fuels yesterday. For those who couldn't make it to the city, there was a local protest. Rosie Starr was on scene, and we'll hear the community's climate concerns during Climate Week. Pre-diabetes is a big deal. Don't let the pre fool you. Pre-diabetes is a serious health condition. Approximately 96 million Americans have it, and of those, more than 80% don't know they have it. We'll learn more about pre-diabetes and diabetes prevention from Shelley DeHaan, Garnet Health Director of Diabetes Education. Plus, the Catskill Conquest Rally commemorating the 1903 Automobile Endurance Run, and Work Shift Live, James B. Huntington. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. and Iran have exchanged several prisoners today. The U.S. says Iran is releasing five Iranians who had been imprisoned, and in exchange, the U.S. is releasing about $6 billion in frozen oil revenues. That money has been moved into a bank in Qatar. The U.S. will also let go of five Iranians held in the U.S. It is not clear if they will go to Iran. President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, is suing the IRS. He claims this is over the federal agency's unlawful release of his private and confidential tax information. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more.
In his lawsuit filed in Washington, D.C. federal court, Biden says the IRS failed to safeguard his private information. The complaint alleges that IRS agents have targeted and sought to embarrass the president's son. Though the complaint doesn't name the agents, it's in reference to Gary Shapley and Joseph Ziegler. The two made public disclosures claiming the U.S. Justice Department gave Biden preferential treatment in its IRS investigation. Biden is looking for all documents tied to the release of his tax information, and the lawsuit says $1,000 for each of the unauthorized documents released of his private information. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
The International Court of Justice is hearing arguments today about Russia's war in Ukraine. Ukrainian officials sued Russia right after it invaded last year. Ukraine says Russia is abusing international law. That's because the Kremlin claims the reason it invaded was to stop an alleged genocide. Russia's representative, Ambassador Gennady Kuzmin, told the court in the Netherlands today Russia wants the case thrown out.
Ukraine's claim in itself and its tactics in these proceedings is a manifest disregard of the proper administration of justice and constitutes an abuse of process.
Ukraine will respond to the Russian statement tomorrow. Stocks are trading lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 36 points. As NPR's David Gura reports, Wall Street's focus this week is on a two-day meeting of the Federal Reserve.
Federal Reserve policymakers are not expected to raise interest rates at this meeting. Wall Street put the odds of no increase at 99%. Investors hope for more clarity on the Fed's path forward from Chair Jerome Powell and from updated economic projections the central bank will release after it announces its interest rate decision. Yields on U.S. government bonds have crept higher. Both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 lost ground last week as oil prices rose and there was a sell-off in tech stocks. That broad-based index, the S&P 500, now has two new members, Airbnb and the private equity firm Blackstone. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 40 points. The NASDAQ is up 6 points. This is NPR. The United Auto Workers are still striking certain automotive plants in Michigan, Missouri, and Ohio today. The UAW and Ford, GM, and Stellantis are still negotiating new contracts. Talks continued over the weekend, but apparently did not progress. A presidential candidate in Taiwan is visiting the U.S. NPR's Emily Fang reports Ho Yo-yi was in New York City over the weekend.
Ho Yo-yi, the current mayor of Taiwan's largest city, shook hands with another mayor over the weekend, Eric Adams of New York City. Ho is Taiwan's latest presidential candidate to make a tour of the U.S., traveling from the Big Apple to Washington, D.C., and then San Francisco, a prerequisite in an election where relations with the U.S., Taiwan's most important ally, is always a key issue. Ho is a former police chief with immense populist appeal among Taiwanese voters. But his lack of international experience has worried even members of his own party, the opposition Kuomintang Party, especially as tensions with China increase. Emily Fang, NPR News, Taipei.
The Libyan Red Crescent says more than 10,000 people are still missing from the massive Mediterranean storm that hit more than a week ago. More than 11,000 people died after two dams collapsed in northeastern Libya. What was Hurricane Lee is back out in the Atlantic Ocean. The National Hurricane Center has dropped all warnings and says Lee will soon weaken. Officials in Maine say one person was killed by the storm after a large tree limb fell on his vehicle Saturday. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tens of thousands of demonstrators flooded the streets of Midtown Manhattan yesterday for the March to End Fossil Fuels, calling on President Biden to take action to phase out fossil fuels and address environmental injustice. Locally, on the Narrowsburg-Darbytown Bridge that spans the Delaware River at Big Eddy, members of the community gathered to express their climate concerns. Rosie Starr was there and filed this report.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. It's Sunday, September 17th. We're on the Narrowsburg-Darbytown Bridge that spans the Delaware River at the Big Eddy. Members of the community have gathered here to express their environmental concerns on issues like climate change. We have in front of me here one of the organizers of this. Many people know Beverly Sterner from the Upper Delaware Community Network. She gathers people in the community, keeping them connected, but I'll let her introduce herself. She'll share with us what she wants people to know.
Hi, my name is Beverly Sterner. And today we are having a demonstration on the Narrowsburg Bridge in order to make people aware in our community that there are major issues that face all of us. There's a major demonstration happening in New York, a mass march against fossil fuels, particularly. And, of course, we have our DCS, the Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, that has fought the fight against fossil fuels. And there are just many issues about our climate and nature that we want to bring to the attention of our citizens here. And so that we can become a more conscious community in terms of not only fossil fuels, but waste and recycling, and getting people involved locally in finding out perhaps where our local banks are invested. Are they invested in fossil fuels? And what about our local businesses? Are they trying to do their business in a more sustainable way? So we have many areas locally that we can work on so that at least our community here is a conscious community and that we're doing as much as we can to be a sustainable community and to educate everybody that we can. As a way of becoming a more conscious community, each one of us individually needs to take a look at our own habits, our own lifestyle, and learn from one another how we can be more conscious of not wasting, of not buying plastics, of helping each other to learn what is most necessary for our living a healthy life, not only in this community, but we know that the world is affected, and although we haven't had any major floodings here recently, we have had a tornado, and we do not know what the future will bring. What we know is that we need to be connected and that we need to do the best we can.
Hi, my name is Barbara Arendelle. I'm director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, or DCS, and we're here on the Narrowsburg Bridge today, September 17th, in order to emphasize the importance of reduction of fossil fuel use and to make sure that there's a future for the younger generations. the parts of the ecology are going extinct, the insects, which are the bottom of the food chain. And without the bottom of the food chain, the rest of the ladder collapses. So let's not be foolish. Make sure we cut way back on fossil fuels. And there's been studies that even just emphasizing efficiency could cut fossil fuel use by half. So let's do that. There is money for people to upgrade their homes, and that's a big use of fossil fuel. And just make sure that you use less, because all the climate impacts are accelerating, and that's not good.
And taking that to the local level.
Local level, you could look at how do we grow food? Can we grow food? This year there was freezes that eliminated a lot of the fruit crops. There's very few insects. So how are things going to get pollinated? There's been floods. There will be more floods. Thankfully, in this area, there hasn't been drought this year, not to the point of fires, thank goodness, but there could very well be. We are not alone in this world. Everything is connected, and we need to look at the broader view and make sure that, okay, so it's not over 100 degrees here. It is over there, but it could very well be here next. And we need to have a view of everything pulling together, and the fossil fuel use has to go way down. We have to campaign for the end of fossil fuel subsidies from our government, our federal government. Locally, we have to make sure that projects are efficient and sustainable. There's some push for some developments that are absurd and kind of crazy. In the immediate area, we have to be aware of what's going on, and we have to make sure our voices are heard, make sure that you and everyone you know is registered to vote in the town, state that you're in, and push ahead in that direction. Otherwise, your voice isn't heard. Acting locally is extremely important. And that's why we're on the Narrowsburg Bridge today, because there's a major march about fossil fuels in New York City. But we're saving carbon by making our voice heard here, where we live.
End fossil fuels now! End fossil fuels now! End fossil fuels now! End fossil fuels now! End fossil fuels now!
Save our water! Our beautiful water! Save our water! Beautiful water! Save our water!
Our beautiful water!
Get rid of the plastic.
My name is Clay Smith, and I'm here because we are in a climate disaster. And it's time for us all to wake up a little bit and change what we're doing for our sake and for the sake of the planet in general.
Well, you mentioned we're in a climate crisis. Are there things in this area here that you feel need to be addressed?
With all the floods and the crazy weather, and I think it's really impacting a lot. And you would know, talking to, you know, farmers and people about the crazy weather and the impact that it has on them and on all of us.
Well, and I believe you're a fly fisherman. Do you have any concerns about the river and climate change?
Yeah, I mean, the trout need cold water, and the water's getting warmer and warmer. And I imagine that if things don't change, that in, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, there'll be different kinds of fish in the river and not trout.
You're holding a sign. What does it say?
It says, conserve what our children deserve. Stop polluting and start living. Save the earth. Save yourselves.
I'm Lisa Glover, and I came here today because I wanted to go to New York City to join the bigger climate strike to protest fossil fuels and to encourage there to be a fossil fuel treaty. But I think it would have been beneficial for me, I think, to be in a crowd of thousands and to be part of something that felt bigger and momentous. But at the same time, having the chance to be in a smaller community and show that these sentiments aren't just in the big cities, that they're here too, and that so many people all over the country want to have an end to fossil fuels so that way we have a chance at a future, felt more important to me. If I was heading to the city, I would have gotten on the train in Port Jervis to save some fossil fuels. I wasn't planning on driving the whole way there, but yeah, it is a little bit shorter to drive half an hour away than it is to drive an hour away. A little bit about me, I do placemaking as my full-time work, and the big thing about placemaking is it's connecting people with place more and making sure that they are more involved in the places that they call home so they take better care of it, and it also meets their needs better. And the past development patterns haven't really encouraged us to connect in with our places. So that's why we've gotten so much suburban sprawl, and it makes it harder to form communities when everyone's further apart from each other. And so one thing that I'm working on is sprawl repair and encouraging communities to look at development patterns that make for walkable, dense downtowns, even in rural areas. That helps to protect our resources. It helps us to drive less. It helps us to form better communities. And all of this creates a lower environmental impact from the humans. I work with a national nonprofit that works specifically with rural communities all over the country.
I'm Lori Stewart. I'm the publisher of The River Reporter. And it's really great that there's people gathering on the bridge to bring attention to people about the fact that we need to be paying attention to climate change. And, I think that we all know the climate is changing, but then we don't really know, since this is a global problem, we don't necessarily know how one person, one family, individually can actually make an effect. However, I do believe that we need to be taking a look at the Earth as a system and looking at our own choices. I know I'm much more aware now. I mean, I have a well. When I'm rinsing my vegetables, washing my produce 3 times, I'm thinking about all that water. You know, when I'm buying things in the store, I'm looking to buy something in glass and not in plastic. And for as much as that one little plastic bottle or not using that one little plastic bottle doesn't necessarily like change everything, it does bring about a certain awareness that runs contrary to how we have been a consumptive society. And we need to start thinking about how much we use and how we can really be doing things so that we're really looking at things that can be reused and that can be recycled. We need to be thinking about our products from cradle to grave. That kind of consciousness and the fact that we're all connected and that we're actually pretty lucky here to not have the extreme climate realities that are actually displacing people right now. What we can do is we can think and really be putting our energy into a whole global kind of consciousness about treading more lightly on our precious earth. And it starts locally. It does.
My name's Cass Collins, and I'm here on the bridge, in the Narrowsburg Bridge, with my granddaughter, Rosemary. And she's the reason that we're fighting for this end to fossil fuels, because without an end to fossil fuels, she's not going to have a future on this planet. And I don't want to have to go to Mars to visit my granddaughter. No, she's the most perfect vision of a human being I can imagine, and I want to leave her a perfect planet. Yes, conserve what our children deserve, says one of these signs. Stop polluting and start living. Save the earth and save yourselves. Yeah, she's all about it. This is her first demonstration, but probably not her last.
Welcome, welcome.
Right, Rosie? You have anything to say? Oh, you have anything to say to the JFF audience? Yeah, your mommy is very proud of you that you're at a demonstration today with Grandma. We said, we know how to, Grandma.
In my dreams.
Climate action. That's how we, Grandma.
Ready for your sound bite? I know you want the microphone. I know you want.
Oh, that's so cute.
I love when babies giggle like that.
The Rosie Star reporting from the Narrowsburg Darbytown Bridge in Narrowsburg, the local climate protest. Thank you for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, pre-diabetes awareness. More than 80% of folks who have it don't know they have it. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hello, I'm Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. Tune in to our headline news service for stories about Indigenous communities across the country and around the world. Hear about top concerns facing Native nations. Tribal history, language, and culture is also part of Indigenous life. Check out our headline news service to learn more. Tune in here for National Native News.
Weekdays during All Things Considered.
Hi, this is Laura Flanders, and you can catch the Laura Flanders Show, which I produce right here in a cabin in Sullivan County every Monday night at 7 p.m. on Radio Catskill. You'll hear interviews with social critics, artists, activists, and entrepreneurs, forward thinkers who are building tomorrow's world today. Deep conversations about change with the leading thinkers and doers of our time. That's the Laura Flanders Show, Monday night, 7 p.m., right here on Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pre-diabetes is a big deal. Don't let the pre fool you. It's a serious health condition. Pre-diabetes puts folks at increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes, heart disease, or suffering a stroke. Approximately 96 million American adults, more than 1 in 3, have pre-diabetes. And of those with pre-diabetes, more than 80% don't know they have it. Garnet Health is offering a free 12-month diabetes prevention program for qualified individuals. Here to tell us more is Shelley Dehan, Garnet Health Director of Diabetes Education. We should note Garnet Health is a financial supporter of WJFF. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Thanks for being here. I was struck by these numbers. 96 million people have it, and then the people that have it don't know they have it. Why do you think that is? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's much like diabetes. When blood sugar levels start to rise, we're not given any kind of strong signal. You know, our body is not recognizing that these levels are rising, much like blood pressure too. You know, a lot of people might have high blood pressure and not know it until diagnosed. But pre-diabetes is the precursor to type 2 diabetes. So when we're looking at just from a statistic standpoint, there are 37 million people that are diagnosed with diabetes, but it's really the other side of the coin, which is the pre-diabetes. And yes, it's represented by 96 million, which is, like you said, 1 in 3 adult Americans. So it is a very high percentage, and people don't know they're walking around with this condition.
And it's where your blood sugar levels are higher than normal, but it's not enough to get diagnosed as type 2 diabetes. So what causes pre-diabetes?
So pre-diabetes, there's a lot of indicators or things that are precursors for people that would be at risk. So the first is being overweight. Age is a contributing factor. Those over the age of 45 are more likely to develop pre-diabetes. If you have a family history, so a parent, brother, sister with type 2, being physically inactive. So if you're not out there, you know, walking and doing things, your risk for diabetes does go up. And then for women that have had a history of gestational diabetes, their risk is also much higher. And so given those parameters, we're talking about people who are at risk, but basically it could be anybody. Those are just those are the higher predetermining risk factors.
And Garnet Health is offering this diabetes prevention program because, you know, pre-diabetes sets the stage for type 2 diabetes down the road. What is it that folks can expect in this prevention program?
Sure. So it is a 12-month, as you said, 12-month program. So it seems like, oh, you know, I have a one-year commitment, you know, to this program. But if we break it down, we're looking at the first half of the program, half of the year. We're meeting pretty much on a weekly schedule. It's a one-hour session, which is done with a certified lifestyle coach in small groups of participants that are all at risk for developing diabetes. And so each of the classes covers different topics related to ways in which you can make changes to your diet, increase physical activity, work on stress management techniques. And all of these sessions lead up to the first 16 weeks. After that's completed, then we go to every other week for the next 3 to 4 months. And then the last 3 months of the year in that program, we touch base once a month to see how people have been able to sustain the changes that they've made.
And pre-diabetes, it's important to see this in advance of getting anything developing into type 2 diabetes, because that can lead to to heart disease as well, or suffering a stroke. And it's important to remember that it's preventable.
Correct. So when we're looking at the diagnosis of diabetes typically we're looking at blood sugar levels that are much higher, and usually for those that have the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, we are not able to reverse the condition. When we're looking at prediabetes is when blood sugar levels are slightly elevated, and this is diagnosed if we have blood work done. We can diagnose levels for blood glucose would be a fasting level of 100 to 125, or what we reference now, which is a better indicator, is the hemoglobin A1C test. And that A1C test is done as a percentage of your glucose molecules that have remained in your body for about a three-month period. So the A1C of 5.7 up to 6.4% is where we're really trying to capture. And most physicians, most primary care doctors are now more alert to looking at a person's, risk factors, and then saying, okay, maybe we should do a preliminary A1C and just see where you stand right now. And you, like we said, 80% don't know that they have this until they've had this test, and then lo and behold, the A1C tells us we have left that normal range of A1C, and we are now in that pre-diabetic range.
You mentioned that the program is a year-long program, and I wonder if people think that treating prediabetes is daunting because of the lifestyle modifications and the different types of ways that you could change this, but even a small change makes a difference.
Yes, and when we do emphasize, making small incremental changes, we're usually looking at, 5 to 7% weight loss, and hopefully we achieve that within the first 6 months, but certainly there are people who continue to, work on their weight loss throughout the course of the year. And then from a physical activity standpoint, it's really about trying to get to initial level of 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. But if we can always, get a person to engage in more physical activity, we know that these two things, weight loss and physical activity, can help and statistically can help to cut the risk of developing type 2 diabetes in half. So it's huge, but people need help. People need guidance. People need coaching and the support of others to get to those goals.
And as we said, most people that have it don't know they have it. There's a simple blood sugar test you can take as well. Is that something that you should ask your doctor about?
Yes. So that's what I had mentioned before, which is what we call the hemoglobin A1C. And now, we're noticing because of all of the efforts that had gone in years and years ago with the National Cholesterol Education Program, people know their target cholesterol should be below 200. So we've gotten that knowledge kind of, it sinks in over time. Now it's about A1C. And a lot of people are really aware of this. When people come in, we have our diabetes program here, and I ask people, what was your initial A1C? People know. They know what that percentage is. So we're doing a better job of educating people around knowing what tests should be done, asking their providers to have the tests done. If you, and there are some health fairs that will screen using the A1C, but you don't have to have an A1C to be the predictor of whether you have prediabetes. You could simply do a risk test. And those risk tests are available online. If people just Google, do I have prediabetes question mark, it'll bring them to an organization that will, on the screen, will walk them through the simple questions, and based upon the answers to those questions, will indicate whether they're at high risk of having prediabetes.
And prediabetes is considered type 1, is that correct?
No.
So,
we look at,
education.
Education. So prediabetes is prediabetes, the precursor to type 2. Okay. So when we talk about diabetes, there are two specific types of diabetes, both type 1, as you referenced, and type 2. Type 1 is an autoimmune disease caused by an autoimmune reaction within the body, which no longer, the body can no longer produce insulin. We used to call type 1 juvenile diabetes, which we don't use that term anymore. We just say type 1. So those with type 1 diabetes require insulin in most cases. Type 2, though, is more of the genetic. Type 2, and percentage-wise, 90% of people will have type 2. Approximately 10% will have type 1. But again, diabetes, you know, is caused by a number of similar risk factors. So type 2, the risk factors are almost identical. So being overweight, again, 45 or older, family history of diabetes, that's the genetic predisposition, physically inactive, we could say also certain ethnicities. So we know those of African American background, Hispanic, Latino, American Indians, Pacific Islanders, and some Asian Americans are also at higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So again, the risk factors are very similar for both prediabetes and type 2.
This is why we're talking about it, so we can learn the differences, and especially prediabetes. It's real, it's common, and it's reversible. Where can folks get more information about the diabetes prevention workshops that you're holding?
Absolutely. So our diabetes prevention program, we do two sessions a year in the spring and the fall. So we are in our launch program for the fall start of the program, which will begin Thursday. So Thursdays will be our day for Catskill for Sullivan County residents and even beyond if, you know, people want to travel up to Monticello Library. And that will be on Thursdays at 11 a.m. And again, to call for, you know, so I can, you know, talk to people more about the program, I certainly welcome that because there are questions when it comes to, do I qualify, you know, and so if you give me a call, my number is 845-333-2705, and I will certainly give you the lay of the land with the program and whether you qualify.
And you can get more information at garnethealth.org as well. We should also mention that Garnet Health Medical Center, in partnership with Garnet Health Doctors, is offering free prostate cancer screenings Monday the 25th and Thursday, September 28th. We've been speaking with Shelley DeHaan, Garnet Health Director of Diabetes Education. Thank you so much for educating me and the listeners about this important area of prediabetes.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, it's Work Shift Live with James B. Huntington, Local Economic Perspective. This is Radio Chatsco.
Support comes from the Women's Health Center in Honesdale, Hamlin, Waymart, Carbondale, and Lords Valley in Pennsylvania. Physicians and certified midwives who deliver. The Women's Health Center is a Wayne Memorial Community Health Center. WMH.org. NACL Theater, Highland Lake. Innovative performance and community action. NACL.org. And from listener donations at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskills Community Awards return September 28th. Join us as we honor the Chantilly Music Festival and Weekend of Chamber Music, both of which are celebrating their 30th anniversaries this year, plus many other local arts organizations. There will be hors d'oeuvres, drinks, good company, and you. Radio Catskills Community Awards, September 28th, Seminary Hill Orchard and Cidery, Calicoon. Tickets at WJFFradio.org.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like the Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill, and it's Monday. That means it's time for Work Shift Live. James B. Huntington, local economist and author, is here to tell us what's going on in the economy. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
All right, we've got a lot to get to, so let's go straight in. Inflation. Oh, my goodness. How did inflation change last month? I think we see it in our pockets at the pump.
Well, in general, it went up 0.5% from 3.2 to 3.7. That's August data. It was boosted by just what you mentioned, energy costs in general and gas more than anything else. So that's what we have.
Yeah, oil is nearing $95 a barrel, and it's definitely being passed on to the consumer. I guess we're looking now to see what's going to happen with the Fed this week and any kind of reaction. What do we think is going to happen with the Fed this week with their meeting?
Well, yes, they are meeting tomorrow and Wednesday, and they are voting, making a decision on interest rates. The Street says rather emphatically that they will not increase rates this time. However, going ahead to November and December, when they have two more meetings, it's likely, or there is a substantial chance, shall we say, that rates will go up again. Probably not a great deal. It will depend to a large extent what the next inflation number looks like and the new jobs report. Actually, October, November, there'll be two jobs reports to look at between now and then. So we don't know, but very likely no interest rate gain this time.
Yeah, usually when a meeting of the Fed is on the calendar, folks are focusing on their decision and making all these predictions. But as you said, most folks are kind of looking to see what they can glean for the next meeting. What are some of the tea leaves they might be looking to read here?
Well, the tea leaves are really the reports I mentioned, the jobs report and the inflation report. We also have one additional thing, and that is the core inflation. That's something they also measure. It's without energy or food. That is 4.3%. That actually declined, but it's been running higher than the other things. So those are the things the Fed is really going to look at, and it'll be their judgment as to what's happening. They may have some other things to look at in the background based on all the rate increases they've had and where things seem to be, and not all that information is available right now, so we can't really say conclusively that we'll know what they're going to do even in November.
You've got some local economic data. What are the latest jobless rates for our listening area?
Yes, well, they stayed almost the same. It was remarkable. This is between June and July. They are similar months, but we have as unemployment Sullivan County at 2.7%, Orange at 3.1%, Ulster at 3.1%, Wayne County at 3.6%, and Pike at 4.8%, except for a 0.1% increase in Orange County. They are identical to the numbers from June. These are just July I gave you. The national unemployment rate, this is unadjusted because these numbers are seasonally unadjusted, also stayed the same between June and July nationally, 3.8%. So it's all quiet on the Catskills and Poconos front. And with the numbers we're seeing right now, that's a good thing. Unemployment is, by national standards, very low around here.
Well, that's good news then. We've got some more information about automation and AI, I guess. Some automation replacing jobs, and what? How could job seekers stay relevant if automation or AI begins replacing jobs?
Well, the main thing is to realize not only to avoid jobs that it seems like AI is going to take over, but to see that AI is going to require its own people to do things. So if you have the inclination and the skills, that's a fine area to get involved with. You can also do good business practices, be aware of what your employer is trying to do and how to further that. Volunteer, do more than required, all of that old stuff is still very much current. But the world of work will need people to develop the knowledge and expertise to manage, monitor, and measure the output of AI. That is a direct quote from a USA Today article from about a month ago. So find ways in general of working with it instead of working against it.
That's also the central dispute in the Hollywood strikes, the artificial intelligence. And there was a headline I saw recently, too, which echoes what you say, embrace it or risk obsolescence. So it's
yes.
Definitely coming. It's just how does it get folded in, which I think is what everyone's sort of focused on.
The same thing, exactly the same thing. They will work out with the strike what kind of role AI will be doing and where AI's work will stop and human writers will take over. And that's a major subject of the strike right now.
Yep, a major subject of our lives, I guess, too. Let's talk about the numbers. How did stock, oil, and all the other numbers end up last week?
Okay, over the past week, we have gold at $1,925, down a dollar, a quiet week for gold. Silver down, up, well, down also 8 cents to $2,308. Not doing much there either. The Dow had a few fine days and used it to end up at 34,907, up 330 for the week. NASDAQ did even better proportionally. They're at 13,926 now, up 164. Oil, as you mentioned, yes, as of Monday morning, as of very early this morning, it was 91.26, which is up over $4. That's going higher and higher. I found out a real reason for that is that Russia and Saudi Arabia, two very large producers, have decided to cut the amounts they're selling. So it may go up some more. Those arrangements have a way of collapsing, so don't pencil it in for 125 in a couple months quite yet, but it may go up a little more. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin had a big week, up 905 to $26,702. British pound down a penny and a half to 1.2371. Euro down about 0.6 cents to 106.60. Both of those countries are doing worse with getting out of the inflation and the pandemic than the U.S. is, and it's showing up in their currency. And the Japanese 100 yen coin at 68 cents stayed the same. Generally a good week, and there's some word going around that stocks could go even higher.
Wow.
So let's hope they're right about that, and let's hope oil cools down a bit.
We'll keep an eye on that. We should note, program note, you're going to take a little break, so we won't see you next week, but we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Very good.
All right. Enjoy your time off. You deserve it. It's James B. Huntington. Work Shift Live comes to us every Monday with local economic perspective. Thank you, James B.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, it's the Catskill Conquest Rally, commemorating the 1903 Automobile Endurance Run. We'll learn more about it right after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskill Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves that help you unwind, exciting rhythms that help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In October of 1903, 17 American auto manufacturers fielded 34 entries for an arduous test. They followed an 800-mile route through the Catskill Mountains in New York and on to Binghamton and Buffalo in New York, Erie in Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Catskill Conquest Rally commemorates that 1903 Automobile Endurance Run, and it takes place Saturday, September 23rd. It's the 120th anniversary of the Endurance Run, and here to tell us more is Robert Selkiewicz, Director of Historic Automobile Endurance Runs. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for being here. This is a piece of history that I was not aware of. Why did these auto manufacturers have this test in 1903? What was it that they were trying to accomplish?
Well, it'd been building, for several years. There was, there were many, many people building automobiles, starting with wagons and putting motors on them. Even Sears had one you could order by mail. And the manufacturers were trying to prove that these could be practical and reliable. So they designed this endurance run as a test where they loaded the cars with passengers and luggage and laid out this route over 800 miles. They went through 14 counties in New York State. And it was not for speed, but if, you know, cars were delayed or had problems, they would, you know, be penalized with points and, you know, so they set off in a drizzly day on October 7th, 1903, took the ferry across the Hudson to Weehawken. It came up the Hudson Valley to Kingston and then proceeded up what is now State Route 28 to Pine Hill for their first overnight. And I wasn't aware. Well, I remembered reading about it a paragraph or two in Alf Ever's book, Wilderness to Woodstock, many years ago. And I was on a committee for the Catskill Mountain Scenic Byway. And we were looking for events. And I raised my hand at a meeting. I said, what about an automobile event? And everybody said, great idea. So I started working on it 8 years ago. And what I discovered was it was also the birth of road building, where it was the transition from the labor system that was under colonial times, where farmers would have to dedicate days of labor to maintaining roads, to a time when the government could issue bonds, and it became a money system with contracts. And what attracted the manufacturers to the Esopus Valley was 20 miles of crushed local bluestone McAdam paving that had been put down since 1899, 1900, 1901, 1902, up the valley, top-of-the-line road building. And so they made it to Pine Hill, and there's photographs of the cars parked. They looked like insects. I mean, these cars were so primitive. They didn't have windshields. They didn't have tops. And then the second day, as they went into Delaware County, a deluge opened up on them of cold, wind-driven rain on the dirt roads, because Delaware County didn't believe in engineers and taxes, hadn't done anything to upgrade their roads. And it became a huge debacle. But they persevered. 25 of the 34 cars made it to Pittsburgh, and they were known afterwards as the Mudlarks.
Kind of appropriate for a day like today.
You know, this wasn't a reenactment. I visited with clubs all along the continuum of every decade, and what we do is a commemoration where all cars are invited. It's non-competitive. There are no trophies. It's a reasonable cost per car to enter. And we start at the Catskills Visitor Center in Mount Tremper. We follow the historic route through the hamlets in Phoenicia and Pine Hill and Fleischmann's and Margaretville. And then this year in Andes, we're going to leave Route 28 and go over Cabin Hill Road to Delancey, stop at Birdsong Farm, proceed to Treadwell and Franklin Railroad Community Museum, head over to Polar Bear Ice Cream, and then Hanford Mills Museum, where they're having their antique engine jamboree. We try to make it an event that celebrates the communities and the landscape, as well as honoring the pioneers of automobiling and the story of the birth of road building.
And one of those pioneers, I guess, on that original 1903 automobile endurance run was Edith Ryker. She was the lone woman on the run. Can you tell us a little bit more about Edith?
Well, when I first started doing this, I invited some friends to my studio and laid out, you know, some of the story. And one of my friends said, "Who is this woman?" Because it was known there was one woman. And through Facebook and other things, I was able to track down their grandson, who is a cartographer in Oregon, who didn't know this story and didn't know the personalities of the grandparents because they'd passed before he was born. But he said his mother had given the locomobile materials. She was her husband, A.L. Ryker, Andrew Lawrence Ryker, was building electric cars and trucks in New York starting in 1897 and was very, very successful with setting speed records with electric cars. And what they were driving in 1903 was his first gasoline engine car, which was labeled as a locomobile. And she went along for the ride. And it turned out that she was a pip with amazing pluck. She was, you know, like a Teddy Roosevelt-era character who went through the whole thing, all of the deluge of mud and sleeping under a tarp and breaking down with a smile on her face, and had some amazing quotes, which we reproduce. I publish a 60-page glossy book with the rally that documents all the history and also includes the rally route and the other rally routes I've created over the years. I'm running four rallies in a year I did this year, and we cover six counties in the Catskill region. So it branched out of the historic route by changing the route a little bit each year and then developing additional rallies. We do a Catskill Covered Bridge Rally on October 14th. We follow 13 creeks and rivers and cross four historic covered bridges. It's a fabulous drive. I have a couple of Corvette clubs that are entering that. It's just, you know, been a great story. And so Edith Ryker, yes, became a focus as the only woman she was interviewed. Mm-hmm. And is featured in some of the magazines that were published documenting, you know, this event. It was the most arduous trial for automobiles that was ever held.
Well, and
you know, they talk about the New York to Paris, but there were just a few cars, and they, you know, put them on a ship to get over to Russia. And this was a continuous slog at a very critical time. It was really the birth of automobiling.
Yeah, and at the time, there were multiple manufacturers of cars. Right now, we refer to the big three automakers. But can you talk a little bit about some of those other cars that became classics?
Well,
and
there
also
were some that were very
that
small. You know, it was people that were, you know, making carriages or doing metalwork decided they would try their hand at it. And some lasted a couple of years. My friend Jeffrey Stein, who's a retired curator from New York State Museum, wrote up an article for me about two of the smaller people that had to enter cars. They were building cars for two or three years, and then they folded. And there was a lot of combinations in the early years. Like the Rikers had the Riker electric car, but then he sold his business to the Columbia Electric Car Company and started building cars for Locomobile. And, you know, my point is that several of the makes, of the 17 makes, became classic American marks, like Packard, Pierce Arrow, Franklin, and Locomobile. And so I've, you know, tried to get a representative of some of those makes to participate. We've had Packard and Pierce Arrow, and this year we have a 1930 Franklin seven-passenger sedan owned by Steve Braverman, who's leading our field. And they're air-cooled cars that were manufactured in Syracuse. And so I do a little article in the rally book about Franklin, and I discovered that Franklin, for a period, was the largest utilizer of aluminum in the world, because Herbert Franklin, the founder, had been in metal casting and wanted lightweight, so he used a lot of aluminum. You know, the engines, you know, were all interesting. It was a great time of innovation. The Franklin in 1903 had a four-cylinder air-cooled front-mounted transverse engine that you think of when you think of the BMC Mini Cooper, the Mini that came out in the early 60s that introduced transverse front engines. And if you look under the hoods of compact cars for years, that was what they did with front-wheel drive. And so it was just, it was fascinating for me to see that in 1903.
Yeah.
There were, you know, myriad of manufacturers. But my rallies tend to get a spread. So we have a 1930 Franklin, and we have a 2021 McLaren 720S, a high-end specialized sports car. And also a 2022 Corvette C8.
Yeah.
You know, they're just for pure enjoyment. I say if you love your car, these are the roads you love to drive.
All right. We got to get going in just a minute here, Robert, but I want to remind folks like where they can get information. Can you tell us where folks can get more information?
There's a website at 1903autorun.com. That's 1903autorun, AUTORUN. .com, 1903autorun.com. And so, you know, I can take more entries for this coming Saturday. We start at the Catskills Visitor Center. I say start together around 9. We'll have a breakfast of some muffins and pastries from Bread Alone. And then this is when we socialize and meet each other and get the rally book and get an orientation. And then I release them a little after 10 o'clock for our first stop at the Margaretville, the Cauliflower Festival.
Well, that'll be great.
Basically, you're released for your day.
Yeah.
The fee for that rally is $100 per car.
Okay.
And then there's also on the homepage the form for that rally and also for the October 14th Covered Bridge Rally, where the fee is $50 per car. And we also start from the Catskills Visitor Center at 5096 State Route 28 in Mount Tremper,
about
18 miles west of Kingston.
All right. Well,
I did run.
We got to. I'm sorry. I got to leave it there, Robert. We've got to get going. But the Catskill Conquest Rally again this Saturday, celebrating 120 years of automobiling in the Catskills. Go to 1903autorun.com for more information. We've been speaking with Robert Selkowitz, the rally master, and also the director of historic automobile endurance runs. Robert, thank you so much for joining us and letting us know about this. And we look forward to seeing all the classic cars out there this Saturday.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. Take care.
All right. We are wrapping it up for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear the shows on our website at wjffradio.org. While you're there, check out the community awards. There's still time to reserve tickets. wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Creek House Grill. Fresh food, drinks, and cocktails on the Delaware River in Calicoon, New York. Menu and hours at thecreekhousegrill.com. From the Forest Berg Playhouse. Live entertainment in the Sullivan Catskills since 1947. with musicals, plays, cabaret, arts education, concerts, special events, and more. Tickets at fbplayhouse.org.
Summertime and the giving is easy.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome back.
Bryan Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville, W233AH, Monticello.